Greetings. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, brought to you by Heart and Soul Broadcasting Services. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. Today, I'm in conversation with Nigel Masimba Munyati, a social entrepreneur and builder of dreams. Enjoy this inspirational conversation. Nigel Masimba Munyati. I love the names that we have, which we don't usually share. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, Nigel.
Thank you, Trevor.
Nigel, you are so many things. Let me see if I get this right. You are a marketer. You are a communicator. You are a sports person. You are a filmmaker, documentary maker. You are a builder of dreams. Which one of these gives you the biggest kick and excitement?
Definitely sport. Football is my passion. It wakes me up every day. I can't wait for the sun to wake me up and to go out there and do, you know, the things I love doing. You know, I joke with a lot of my friends, you know, who used to know me in my previous life in the corporate world, and now see me, you know, involved in football. And they're like, Nigel, what went wrong? And I'm like, nothing. I just realized
that,
what I was doing wrong.
That question, actually, Nigel, what went wrong? Shouldn't Nigel be playing football? That's a strange question.
Yeah.
A reflection of our society when it comes to the importance of sports. Talk to me about that, Nigel.
Yeah. In fact, the two things that I love doing tend to be looked down upon by society. Sports and the arts. You know, there's this general feeling that if you play football or you play music or are into film, you know, you are what they call zimarombe. You know, you never will make anything successful out of your life, which I find very tragic because it's only in our parts of the world where that mindset is.
Where does that mindset come from?
I think it comes from our background, our colonial background, you know, where you will find that football, for example, was always considered, you know, a lower quality sport. Rugby was looked at differently. Cricket was looked at differently. So you will find that even going to our academic system, most of our schools, you know, it's changed a bit now, but they used to play football and do athletics. Those were the main sports. You know, in your group A or the former white schools, you know, they'd play rugby, they'd play cricket because they were supposed to be, you know, for the upper, you know, social status. So I think as a result of that, football never really got the respect that it needed to.
It has never gotten
it's
the respect.
It's never got it in Zimbabwe. You know, and I think that has affected its development and its evolution to being, you know, the greatest revenue earner globally that football is today. You know, there's no other sport that generates the kind of revenues that sport does or that has so many supporters. You know, you've got, you know, millions, if not billions.
How do we change that mindset, Nigel? Because it's not just football. It's sports as a whole. As a whole. You know, if you say to people, "I'm a sports person," they look down upon you. You're not bright enough. That's why you ended up playing sports. If you say you're an actor, you're not bright enough. That's why you're not a doctor or an accountant. How do we change that mindset? Will we ever be able to change that mindset?
I think so. You know, I think times are changing. People's mindsets are changing. They're also, you know, the exposure to the global environment is also getting people to wake up to say, hey, you know, yes, a doctor used to be one of the highest paid, you know, professions, or a lawyer, you know, used to be one of the highest paid professions. But nowadays it's David Beckham or Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, who earns more than
Jay-Z,
his doctor.
Jay-Z, you know?
Exactly. You know, so I think the younger generation is going to affect a lot of that change. Our older generation, which is really more our parents, they were brought up under a different, you know, cultural environment.
You know, I'm finding, Nigel, I don't know if you're finding the same thing, that A lot of my friends, their kids have gone into acting, music, you know, the artsy-fartsy kind of thing, sports. Yeah. They are going for trials with Real Madrid, with Manchester United. Mm-hmm. Our parents would not have allowed us to do that. Our children are going there. Talk to me about that, if that's the experience.
It is. And, you know, running an academy, you know.
We'll get to that. Academy, absolutely.
My experience has been, you know, quite interesting in that I have kids who've come to my academy and say to me, Mr. Munyati, please don't ever let my father know that I come to play soccer. Because each time he finds out, he beats me up.
Wow.
You know. And some of those boys, they are playing in the Premier League today. And the fathers are now proud of those sons because they're now earning, they're doing well. But before that, you know, they would not allow them to do so. You know. So, you know, it is changing because obviously those products are now influencing other parents. I'm sure even this young man's father is probably now saying something that is very positive about football to other parents and maybe encouraging them more. But you still find their pockets here and there. What I love more is the, you know, we run what do you call a Saturday soccer program, which brings in, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 year olds. You know, there's a difference there. You know, the young parents are so enthusiastic about their children playing sport that, you know, they are actually the ones that are driving the future of sports in Zimbabwe.
That's good to hear.
So the future is bright.
That's
the past was, you know, rather murky, but I have every confidence that things are going to change here.
Mm. You know, one of the things that attracted me to you, to have you here, is precisely that our sports is looked down upon. But you are one of those people, a professional person, a graduate from Penn State University, and you reminded me as I was reading that there's people like Dr. Tawia Murewa, medical doctor, the flying doctor, playing football, Roderick Muganiri, Dr. Roderick Muganiri, playing football. And I was saying to myself, what more do we need to do to have more of Roderick Muganiri's, Murewa's, Munyati's, people who are qualified as chartered accountants, medical doctors, you know, veterinary scientists or whatever, playing football and all of us respecting what they do.
Well, I'm one of those people who's determined to change that mindset. And one of the things we're doing now, you know, at our academy is that we have 74 boys.
Shall we go there? And this is the Black Aces Academy, is that what it's called?
Just Aces Youth Soccer Academy.
Talk to us about, first of all, why Aces Youth Academy? Why did you start it and what you're doing?
Okay. It's a very interesting story. When I came back from college in the United States in 1981, you know, I was playing soccer in the States. I played for my college team.
Penn State.
We actually made it.
First team for that matter.
First team, yeah. We made it to the national championships, lost in the semifinals. But, you know, that was a fantastic experience that I had there. And I'd always played soccer here. You know, as a kid, I was fanatical about soccer. You know, let me tell you this.
Yeah, before please. Absolutely.
You know, as a kid, I think I was about 10 years old or so. You know, I broke another kid's leg. You know, we used to play, you know, your neighborhood team's soccer. You know, I was born in Highfield, grew up in Highfield. So our team, it was one of the most successful teams. But I had this unfortunate incident where I went into a tackle with this kid and he broke his leg. You know, and for the longest time, you know, I had to sit in the on the sidelines, you know, because none of the other teams would play our team. They say, if Nigel is in it, we're not playing you. But, you know, so that's how passionate I was with football. I played in high school. I then played in university. Now, when I came back, my eldest brother, Rodwell, was a Black Aces official, you know, was doing their marketing and media. And as soon as I landed, you know, in Zimbabwe, he says, you will not play for any other team other than Black Aces. And I'd actually been a Black Aces fan as a kid as well, so it wasn't a problem. Then it was Chibuku.
Yeah.
I was a Chibuku Shumba fan. I joined Black Aces and I played for Black Aces. I didn't play for very long. I had a very serious problems of appendicitis. My appendix burst. I think it was like 2-3 months after I'd returned. And I had peritonitis. So I was in the hospital for almost a month where they had to put in tubes down my gut to drain the green stuff that was in there. So when I came out of, you know, I recovered from my illness, I didn't really have the same drive, the enthusiasm to play again. Because, you know, it takes you such a long time to recover and the season is coming to an end.
Training.
And here I was a, you know, qualified food scientist who had just come to Zimbabwe. And I then decided, you know what, let me just focus on my professional career, academic career.
So if this hadn't happened, you wanted to be a professional football player?
If it had been possible, I would have become a professional football player.
Right.
You know, but it was, you know, terminated early. But, you know, it also gave me the opportunity to look at the other side of football, the administrative side of football.
Yeah.
Because I think that's where the biggest problem is. One of my memorable negative experiences with football was, you know, we were playing Supersonic in Bulawayo. And so we were told we'd take a bus from Machu Picchu Shopping Center. A bus was going to come and pick us up and would then travel to Bulawayo. I had my own car. I actually had my girlfriend take my car back home because, you know, we were now waiting for the bus. Supposed to have gotten onto the bus, I think, around 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock came, nothing. 5 o'clock came, nothing. Around 6 o'clock, that's when one of the officials was like, no, the bus isn't there anymore, so we have to go and take your, you know, typical chicken bus kind of thing. You know, and this is the kind of bus that would stop in Norton, stop in Jegutu, and you've got people selling eggs.
You're going to a football match.
We're going to a football match, you know. We get to Kwekwe now, it's like in 8, 9, 10 o'clock kind of thing, and they're like, well, it's too late now to continue. So we had to put up at some hotel in Kwekwe. You know, the club officials managed to get 2 rooms. So we had 4 beds for the whole team. So you can imagine like 4 of you sharing 1 bed, you know, 2 on one end. And it was, you know, and this is a young man who's just come back from America, where sometimes when we travel to matches, you know, you'd fly. And
even you've got your own bedroom.
Or... yeah, you know. You know, we got to Bulawayo, you know, around maybe 1 o'clock. And even then, we didn't have a bus to take us from the rank to the stadium. We had to get a combi that took us to the stadium. And, you know, when we got in there, we didn't have time to relax and to recover from this horrible traveling experience. And, you know, we lost, I think, 5-2.
To Supersonic?
Yeah. You know, there was this young man, what was his name? Boyman. Brilliant, you know, I think he was a hero at our expense. I think he scored a hat trick. But it was after that trip that I asked myself, do you really need this? Mm. You know, you love the game, but this is not how it should be.
Mm.
You know, so I think after that, I just kind of decided that, you know, I wanted to try something else. Fortunately, you know, Dairy Board had a Division I team. I was now the assistant regional manager in Harare, at the Harare
Dairy Board.
It's also the time when Rio Tinto decided they wanted to disinvest from football. And so they approached us to partner, and we agreed on a 2-year arrangement where, you know, they would basically ease out over a 2-year period. And that's how Rio Dairy Board became a reality. It was a combination of Dairy Board and Rio Tinto. And me being the assistant regional manager and a football fan, management asked me if I could be the chairman of the club. And I think I was like 24, 25, you know. And I said, yeah, okay. So I chaired, you know, co-chaired with one of the executives from Rio Tinto.
From Rio Tinto.
And, you know, we had 2 seasons, not brilliant, you know. It's always a problem when one half is really not into it anymore. It wasn't the old Rio Tinto that used to be. But that's how I got involved in football administration.
Right.
So, I became the chairman of Rio Dairy Board. And then, a couple of years later, Black Aces, their chairman, his name was Ricardo, he suddenly died. I think it was meningitis or something like that. So Black Aces approached me and said, a former Black Aces player seemed to be doing well in the corporate world. Why don't you come and be our chairman? So I said, okay, I will chair. But I said only for a season, because really that's when I was starting to get involved in, many more things. So I chaired Black Aces, and who did I find there? It was Mark Duvillard.
All right.
Mark Duvillard was the coach of Black Aces. So together, we formed up a very, very successful, partnership. That's the time when Black Aces won the BP Cup,
They were hot.
Yeah, in those days, very, very successful. And the team that we had young players, your Tinashe Ngumashas and so on. And the average age of the players in that time, at that time was like 18, 19, maybe a few 20-year-olds. So we were actually very successful with a team that was young. And Mark and I both believed in young players, contrary to what is still happening today in Zimbabwe. You've got coaches that want older players. I don't understand it, but that's how
So
they.
is that then how you then get the idea to start with Mark Duvillard to
Yes,
start Aces?
exactly.
Talk to us about the what you
Yeah.
do at the Aces Academy.
Yeah. After the success at Black Aces, we said to ourselves, this is very good. We've shown that young players, with a team of young players, you can be successful. But there is need to take this process to its logical beginning by starting with young boys and girls and developing them into professional players. And that's how the idea of Aces Youth Soccer Academy was born. We took our aces with us, but left the club behind. And we started the academy in 2001 was when we registered it with the SRC then.
And talk to me about how it's funded and how you identify the talent.
Yeah, we've been fortunate, mainly through Mark, to be able to access foundations in Sweden and Switzerland that have been funding us. Our academy, our annual, budget is about $250,000, and we've been fortunate enough to be able to get that kind of support. We celebrated our 20th anniversary last year. So we've been doing this for
This is an
20 years.
institution,
It
eh?
is. It is. And, coming back to the whole concept of rescuing our sport, I see what we have done. We're the pioneers in, football academies in Zimbabwe and the whole concept of development. We've created a new approach to developing young players, which, a lot of others have, I don't want to say copied, but they have picked up on and taken it to their own levels. But I think we've inspired, a lot of, people that love the sport from an administrative and also mainly from a developmental,
How do you
perspective.
scout for talent, and how long does it take for them to come out through your pipeline, as it were?
Yeah, this is something that is quite interesting because we hardly scout. We used to do it in the older days. We used to attend football tournaments, school tournaments, and then we would identify the young talent that is there. But nowadays, because of the popularity of our academy, we are inundated. I could show you my phone today, at least two or three messages that come in from kids out there or parents that are saying, I want to join the academy. How can I do that? Or my child, is very talented. How can I get them to join the academy? So we send away more young talent than
So
we
answer that
take in.
question. How does my child get to join the academy?
We have what we call a Saturday soccer program, where kids come in every Saturday 9 to 11. They pay $5 and, you know, they get trained by our coaches. This is a program that says, you know, it's not every kid that wants to be a Ronaldo or a Messi, but they love the game. Mm. They just want to be able to play it well. So, you know, we have this clinic where kids can learn to play such that, you know, whether they're playing at school or for a club somewhere, you know, they're enjoying the game because they're doing the right things.
Right.
And they have no intent of going beyond. But you will get maybe 20% of them that are actually interested in going beyond. So what we do is we also use those clinics to identify potential. So right now I can tell you there are 8-9-year-olds in our Saturday soccer program.
9-year-olds.
Yeah. That I can tell you already, you know, are going to be part of our academy.
Oh, wow.
You know.
You have produced some stars that have played for the national team.
Mm-hmm.
First league football. Talk to me about those. What names are those?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're proud to have produced talents like Nola Jimsona, Kama Biliat, you know, George Chigoa, and, you know, the Amidu brothers. You've got Brett and his older brother, and a lot more. We've got right now, you know, the younger generation. We've got Martin Mapisa. We've sent four of our players to Spain. They are playing in the lower divisions in Spain, but progressing up the, you know, the ladder. You know, Spain is a very challenging environment. You're not just going to shoot up to La Liga just like that. But even the lower leagues are of a much higher quality than you will find in other countries, you know. So, because of that, you know, we have been the single largest supplier of talent to Zimbabwe's national team since 2010.
Wow.
And that is
That's beautiful.
All the levels, you know, whether it is your senior team, your under 23, under 20, under 17s, even the girls' teams, you know, the women's team that went to the Rio Olympics 2016, we had five of our girls who graduated.
They graduated. That must give you joy.
It does. You know, it does. I always say that, you know, when I'm talking to people, but especially to the young ones who are in my academy, and I say to them, I don't do this for money. You know, I always say to people that think that we make a lot of money that they are wrong. If you are doing this for money, you are in the wrong business. You know, to me, and I say this to them, your reward to me, the payback, is your success, not the money that may come out of it. If money comes, which sometimes it does, well and good, but that is not why we do this. You know, for us, it started off actually as a social development program. You know, in the early 2000 period, you know, there are a lot of AIDS orphans. You know, that's when AIDS was at its peak, you know. We even bought a house in Waterfalls, which we use as a clubhouse now. But it was a house to, you know, for the young boys and girls who were actually AIDS orphans or kids coming from homes that have been really wrecked by AIDS, It's now a single parent home, and in most cases, the single parent was the mother who's already struggling, you know, selling, you know, vegetables in the market or along on the side of the road and so on. And so some of them, we had to bring them in to say, well, you know, for an athlete to really thrive, they need a certain environment, you know, nutrition and so on. You're talking about kids who would probably have one decent meal a day. And would now bring into the academy where they have three very good meals and two snacks in between.
Wow.
You know, so you can actually see how they thrive when they come into the academy.
Touch on a very important point as far as I'm concerned, which is why we do what we do. And you've just said, you say to people, if you do this because you think of you think you're going to get money, then that's the wrong motive. Talk to me about the joy that this brings to you, and talk to me about the why.
Mm. Mm. Just watching, come on a Saturday morning to Standard Chartered Sports Club where we run our Saturday soccer program. Just seeing a three-year-old running around, kicking the ball,
Oh.
and just enjoying themselves, it's something that really tags at your heartstrings. It's like, this is good because it also reminds you of where you've come from, your childhood and so on. I come from a family of social entrepreneurs, so it's actually inevitable that I ended up being one as well. I remember my father each time, we used to play in the street outside the house, that's where we play. And my dad, when he's passing through, coming into the
Borrow my
house,
paper.
he'd always say, "Bring the ball here."
Yeah.
He'd always want to show us how
Yeah.
it's done, and we'd miss sometimes and so on. And my friends would laugh after my dad is gone, but
Yeah.
he was that enthusiastic. And it just makes you even want to do it more. I say to people, and well, it's not me, it's not my philosophy. I think that's how, most people look at careers and so on. You need to find something that you're passionate about, something that wakes you up every morning. You can't wait to get up in the morning because you want to go out there and do it. And that's what I found, in football. And you just need to find a way of making it pay you enough to have a comfortable life. Not a luxurious life, but you need to be comfortable in life to be able to do the things that need to be done. And that's what we do. And that's what I do personally. The money that comes in, because sometimes, when you transfer players, there is an income that comes in.
Yeah.
We plow it right back into the academy,
Wow.
and we now do this as a family. My wife is also involved. She's actually the legal. And administrative director. She actually went and attended this CIES FIFA course
Yeah.
at Nelson Mandela University. That's how we are, involved in the game. She was a diplomat, and we were based in the she was in the States for 13 years, and at our mission to the United Nations, and then she eventually joined the UN itself. But at some stage, we decided to come back home because we had started this thing, and for a while, my partner was running it while I was away, being a diplomatic spouse.
How is that? How is it like to be a diplomatic spouse? Must be the life.
It is the life, but it also challenges you in terms of your morals, your standards, your cultural inhibitions, and so on. Because here you are, your wife is
Is the breadwinner, is it?
yeah.
Where?
I would be at home, take the kids to school, mill around with the other mothers who have brought their kids to school. And then you go home, you prepare lunch, you prepare
I
dinner.
like the mill around with the
But I think that's it also requires that you have a very strong partnership. And that's what my wife and I have. We have a very, strong partnership. We're friends and we do things for each other. So I did that for her, and now we came back. She actually gave up a diplomatic career
Wow. So you've
to
swapped places. You
exactly.
swapped. Nigel, you have been involved with Zifa. When you went to Zifa, I'm going to put you on the spot now. When you went to Zifa, you said it's time for change of the mindset.
Yes.
Did you achieve what you went into Zifa to do? Did you manage to reset that mindset as far as the administration of football in this country is concerned?
No.
No. Why?
Why? Because it is a huge iceberg. When you're going into it, you think it's just a little cone on top that you need to just, take care of, only to realize that underneath the surface, there is a huge, huge iceberg.
Describe the aspect to us.
The iceberg is about incompetence in its administrators, but more seriously, the lack of governance. It has become an accepted practice that things are done in a less than
competent, professional way.
Yeah, you know, and it's accepted like that, and it's been like that for maybe the last 30 years, maybe even going back to before independence. You know, if you look at the presidents of the Football Association, you know, elections for the Football Association, it is expected that, you know, you have to pay the voters if you want to get elected, you know. And I thought I could change that, you know. After my time with on the Zifa board, I became so frustrated that I decided to challenge the then president, Mr. Dube. And, you know, I mounted my campaign, but I even said it in the media, in my interviews in the media, that we needed to change that mindset, that you should pay for your votes. Because I was arguing that the promise of what I can do for our football, and you've already seen what I was doing. You know, we did a few very good things. I was the board member marketing for Zifa. And we did a few things which unfortunately were countered by resistance. You know, actually people resisting you doing a good thing because it challenges, you know, the president. But anyway, we went for the elections, you know, and I can tell you the others put in thousands of dollars into buying votes. I told the councillors, you know, what we call the assembly, that I was not going to pay for their votes. I went around the country and spoke with them and sold them my vision, what I was promising to do for football, and all that. But I was not going to pay them for their votes because we wanted to change the way we did things in Zimbabwe in football. And they all said, yeah, you know, it's a good idea, you know. You know, one elderly gentleman who's late now, rest his soul, he actually called me in the evening after I'd been with him in the afternoon. He says, you know, Omunyati, everything that you've said was very nice. Everything you're promising to do, it's been very nice. But this other person has been looking after my family for the past 4 years. And if you're telling me that when you become president, you're not going to be doing that, by voting for you, I would actually be bringing starvation into my family. And I'm afraid I can't do that. I had to say to him, well, if that's how you look at life, Wakuru, there's nothing I can do. You know, I will understand. But that's how sad that reality
is. That's how big that iceberg is. Yeah,
you know.
So you gave up on moving this iceberg, surfacing this iceberg?
I decided that maybe I could do better from the academy side of things, from the development side of things. The administration, I couldn't do anything about now because I was out of the system anyway.
Yeah.
You know. So I went back to my academy and we continued to develop. And I think I've already made a very significant contribution to the development of our football.
But you're now with the Sports and Recreation Commission, am I
correct?
Am I right? Mm. I mean, this iceberg surely must be floating towards that area, or you might be encountering some of the tendencies from that iceberg.
We've already done a lot to chip away at that iceberg, you know.
What have you done?
What we have done is basically started a process of reforming Zifa. They have been resistant because they've always had this philosophy that, you know, if you try and tell us what to do, we'll always run to Mother FIFA, and FIFA will support us, you know. And for the longest time, the other you know, boards of the SRC have caved into that. They've been threatened by Zifa, and they've cowed as a result of that. We've refused to do that. And we've persevered, and we've got to the extent where we even suspended
Zifa board. Eh?
Yeah, the Zifa board, which resulted in FIFA suspending Zifa or Zimbabwe.
Where are we with that sorry state of affairs?
We have reinstated the board because What then happened is that Zifa itself, the assembly, the councillors, took the necessary corrective action on their own. And they removed the three board members who were, you know, the major culprits in terms of lack of governance, in terms of the abuse of women, and generally, you know, maladministration. So there's a new board now. Well, it's the same board, but with other members like the current acting chairman, acting president, rather, Gift Banda. He had been suspended by his own colleagues, you know. So he's now back and is now, you know, leading the crusade to turn the association around. And I think, you know, they will do that.
Are we now in good, is now Zifa and SRSC in good books with FIFA?
Well, we have always been, you know, even as late as, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we still talk to FIFA, you know, where we are engaged with FIFA. What has since happened now is that, you know, after the, you know, extraordinary general meeting that Zifa had, and they created a new board, they have now since reported back to FIFA to say this is what has happened and so on. And they're now waiting for feedback from FIFA. And I think FIFA is still considering, you know, the various permutations as to which one will work for them. So we are waiting to hear from them. We also wrote to FIFA and told them that we've now unsuspended Zifa. So it's really now the ball is in their court, and we're hoping that any time now we'll hear from FIFA. I have a feeling that they are going to reinstate Zimbabwe back into football. Okay.
Are you hopeful about you know, dealing with this iceberg as far as our football and sports administration is concerned? Because you're now in the Sports and Recreation Commission.
Yes. I'm very encouraged by the fact that FIFA themselves have also now come to accept that there is need for reform in Zimbabwe's football. So they are actually willing to work with us. The new board also, you know, seems to be much more professional in its approach and more dedicated to change. You know, one of the weaknesses that we have had in Zimbabwe is that there hasn't been a coordinated junior development program. You know, when I grew up, you know, there used to be leagues all around, you know, the urban areas, and even at national level. You know, now there has been none. It's dead. You know, all of your professional teams had a juniors team. None of them had that. They're only starting now. And in fact, as I speak today, Zifa have called in all the academies because they want to now start a junior football league.
Oh, wow. That's
a national
good.
League.
That's good.
Know, which is very good. Yeah. And I'm really excited about that. But I can tell you that it is because of what we've been doing from the SRC side. If we kept quiet, we would still not have a junior football
league. Tell me, the problems that we experience as a country in sports and football, are they mirrored in Europe, for instance? Do we have the kind of the iceberg that you're talking about?
No. There are still problems. You know, the fundamental problem is there's a lot of money in football, you know, and it's very tempting. You know, talking about, you know, billions that, you know, the international football economy generates. So whenever you've got that kind of money flowing, it's bound to, you know, have people feel that they can take a little and get
away with it. And attract the wrong kind of people.
It will attract the wrong kind of people, yes. And that's what you have in Zimbabwe. You have the wrong people involved in football. It goes back to what we were saying about, you know, our culture of thinking that football is for the failures, you know. And yet there's a lot of money there. So you now have people, the higher, I am trying to not insult the current people involved in football.
Please don't.
But the more professional people are in, you know, other professions and not in football.
Nigel, the sad thing is that, I mean, over the weekend I was watching the Springboks play Wales. And to see the passions that sports excite. So see the national brand being uplifted because sports being done in the right kind of way. Are we aware that through this maladministration, mm-hmm. this iceberg and corruption, mm-hmm. we are hurting the potential of sports in it becoming a national unifier in as competent as a professional way as possible. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with me there?
I agree with you completely. And now, you know, it's national level. You're starting to get the government appreciating more the importance of sport.
As a nation builder.
As a nation builder, exactly. The problem that you have had in the past is that there's also the very negative side of our politics, you know, of politicized sport.
Mm.
Because sport is deemed, which I think wrongly, as being a producer of votes. I don't believe so. I think, you know,
it's a crowd puller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so you will find that, you know, most of our politicians will not have any interest in sport at all.
Except for election time.
Election time, I can tell you, starting January next year, the number of tournaments that you're going to see around the country will be amazing. The amount of money that they will put into those tournaments is amazing. And then you ask yourself, but, you know, if they could put all this money into the development of football or sport generally, you know, it would create such a positive environment for them politically that they won't need to do what they
But they don't get it.
They don't, unfortunately. Yeah. You know,
Nigel, one of the things that you admire that you do is that you co-founded the Zimbabwe International Film Festival Trust.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about why you did that and what the trust does.
Okay. That now takes me back to my other life as a communicator and marketer. Me and my late brother, Mike, started a communications
May
company.
May he so rest in peace. May, amazing yes, man. So amazing
it's true.
Man.
It's a great loss to this nation.
Yeah.
But such is life, you know.
Mm.
I grew up in a family that has been involved in film and TV. You know, my mother was involved in TV. She started the first TV program for black children in the then Rhodesia. There was a program called Fukumbwe every Saturday with kids.
Who was your mother, by the way?
My mother is the late Tsitsi Constance Marua Munyati. She was the first deputy minister of primary education at Independence, one of the first senators. I think there were only three female senators at Independence. She was one of them. And, you know, so she was a pioneer in early childhood education. And so, you know, did a lot to help, you know, our young children, you know, grow.
Mm.
So she worked for it at ZBC. My father was also involved at ZBC. You know, he was a set designer. Mm. So he used to build the sets, which is something that you don't find at ZBC today. There are no TV sets being designed at all. You know, but this is a skill that was available because my dad was, you know, into carpentry and metalwork and so on. And then my two brothers, Mike and Rodwell, they were newscasters on ZTV. And my brother Mike went on to host his own programs, you know, Guest of the Week and The Nation.
The Nation.
Yes. You know. So after all that, he decided that, you know, he had had enough of that. And I'd also now left. I was working for Sheraton then as a director of marketing for Africa. I decided, you know, I can do this for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So him and I got together and we started Munyati Consulting, you know. And most of the work we did combined marketing consultancy, but also on the communication side involved producing a lot of videos, corporate videos for our clients. And that got us into dealing with a lot of production houses.
Aha.
You know, and through that, you know, I got to become quite familiar with people involved in film until one day a guy called Dan Javits, mm-hmm. who had his own production house, said to me, you know, Nigel, you know, given the influence and the connections you have in the film industry. Why don't we start, you know, a film festival? I said, great idea. Let's do it. And that's how, you know, the Zimbabwe Film Festival got started.
Mm.
That was in 1997.
Mm. What have you been able to achieve?
Ooh, we've done a lot.
Just a few things?
Just creating an awareness of the importance of film as a medium of communication.
Mm-hmm.
Helping aspiring young filmmakers become filmmakers. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a program called the Short Film Project at ZIFT. And the Short Film Project basically is designed to help filmmakers make their first film. Mm-hmm. We'll help them make their first film, and thereafter, you know, they go out into the world and start making films.
Mm-hmm. I'll press you there. Mm-hmm. Why is it important for us to make our own films?
It goes back to being able to tell our stories. Mm-hmm. And I can talk about this a little bit more later. But part of the problem is that we are not doing enough to tell our stories. There's not enough support for the filmmaker. Again, going back to both the private sector and government failing to appreciate the importance of a filmmaker and the need to support the filmmaker. You know, let me tell you this story that I always say is the problem. I'll start with the private sector.
Mm.
You know, the private sector company is having problems with its business. Sales are down or its image is not as it should be. You know, they'll call in their PR company or ad agency and say, hey, guys, how can you help us? We need to increase, you know, our sales, or we need to improve our image. And the, you know, agency will say, no problem. We can sort that. We can fix that. And they will, you know, come up with a script or a concept. And then they'll go to a production house. And ask them to produce a video or an advert for them. And who's doing that? There's a filmmaker who's behind all of that. It's the filmmaker that makes the film that will then make the company, you know, achieve greater sales or look much better to the, you know, public. And, you know, everything is happy after that. And then they said, oh, wonderful, thank you, ad agency, you know, things have gone well. What they forget is that there's that filmmaker was involved. And the next time the filmmaker needs money to go and, you know, do his work, he goes to a bank, and it could be the bank that they actually did this for. And the filmmaker will be wearing sandals and he's got dreadlocks. And as soon as he walks into the manager's office, the manager is like, no, I'm sure he smokes, you know, weed, and I can't trust him. You know, and he will not give that filmmaker money. He will say, no, he doesn't understand our language. Mm. You know, I like that. You know, he doesn't understand our language, the business language.
Where's your business plan?
You know, so that is the fundamental problem that we have here. In other parts of the world, they've managed to get over
find
that.
A formula of funding that guy with his techies and his...
Exactly. And manage him if that is what is needed. Manage how that money is spent. Because also the truth is that most of our creatives are not very good administratively or in managing money.
Because they're creatives.
Exactly.
And let me press you again. Why is it important for us to tell our own stories?
You know, there's someone who says, if somebody knows more about you than you know about yourself, they have control over you.
Mm.
Right, yeah. I will know certain things about you that you don't. Yeah. That is the scenario here. And if you want to know about the history of Zimbabwe today, you're going to be looking at books or films or work that has been produced
by others,
not us. All right, and then you wonder why they have control over us. It's because they know more
about
us.
And why we have a low image of ourselves.
Yes, because that pride comes from knowing who you are and being comfortable and confident about who you are, you know, and we don't. So someone ends up defining us for us and not us defining ourselves, you know. I've been doing a lot of work in the respect of wanting to know more about us, you know, our history, our culture. And believe me, there's a lot that we could be doing today, you know, and that would make us very proud of ourselves.
What does it take to have a vibrant film industry in Zimbabwe? What would it take? What is it, if I was to say, give the government a shopping list, what would that be? What would that look like?
Well, for government, a start is they need to believe in the artist.
That's easy, that.
You know, that they mean well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, government itself does not understand film yet.
Mm-hmm.
And despite, you know, having the ministries that are involved and so on, they still don't. You know, and as a result, they end up looking at government, as film, as a vehicle for propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if you look at film as a vehicle for propaganda, you will look at the other side as you know, enemies of what you're trying to do.
Mm.
You know, and I find that very, very sad. There's a lot of young, you know, well-meaning filmmakers out there who have faced the wrath of our government.
Absolutely.
Because they dared disagree. You know, disagreement does not necessarily mean that I hate you or I want you to die or to end whatever you're doing. It just means that I have a different point of view.
Mm.
And there is a lot of merit in us being accepting of other points of view. If we are if we fail to do that, you know, we will never progress as a people.
Mm. And in certain instances, Nigel, it's just ideas.
Mm.
And not even a point of view, but ideas. I've got this film, and this is what the film narrates.
Yeah.
And there's a huge disagreement there. Yeah. About this other project, important project that you're involved in with narratives from Zimbabwe. What is it about? What's the thinking about and why you went into it?
It actually emanates from the whole concept of film, what we're talking about why film is important and why telling our own stories, you know, is important. We started this project, I would say, around 2018. As ZIFT.
Right.
Where each year we have a theme for the festival.
Also, it's part of ZIFT.
Yes.
Right.
We came up with this concept of narratives from Africa. In 2018, all of our films were basically dedicated to films from Africa because we'd always been presenting films from Europe, from America, and so on. And we felt that we're not doing enough to give, you know, African productions enough air.
All right.
You know, so that's how it started. And we, you know, we registered some success,
right?
You know, in that it gave focus to African filmmaking and the challenges that we face. The next year, we then said, well, we've done Africa. Now, why don't we look at narratives from Zimbabwe? And, you know, one of the things that we found was disappointing was the little that was available of Zimbabwean films. We ended up bringing in films from elsewhere because they weren't enough from Zimbabwe.
Mm.
You know, and we then thought maybe this is the time to start doing something about it. You know, why is it that Zimbabweans are not making enough films? And most of the films that are produced in Zimbabwe are dramas, you know, which are the easiest to do. You know, why aren't we doing documentary films? Why aren't we doing other types of films? And on documentary films, we realized that, you know, part of the challenge is that we don't have enough content for them to work on. Because most of it involves getting into doing research, getting into the archives and so on. And you might then bring up things that government might not be happy about. So filmmakers just say, you know, let me just do my dramas.
Wow.
You know.
But we're losing that.
Exactly. So we felt, well, why don't we help by creating access to content for filmmakers? So the idea was we're going to do research and produce a material that a filmmaker can then say, okay, I want to do something and about my history and I can find it. If I go to ZIFT, we're going to create a digital archive, which would be available to filmmakers for content. So what we decided to do was to go around the country and try and address all the major ethnic groups, talk to their chiefs, talk to their traditional leaders, and, you know, and this is all on film. And, you know, create this knowledge that is there, but it's just not being managed in a manner that is easy for the filmmaker to access. So we started in the Eastern Highlands. We did the Ndau. We did, you know, the Manyika, and went up north. You know, we did the Kore Kore, the Chikunda, you know, and fascinating stuff. You know, one of the things that I'm proud of myself is that we actually filmed a Sekiro in a trance. Normally, they don't allow you to do that. You know, they don't like being recorded where they're in the trance. But this guy, well, not guy, this this special gentleman in Kanyemba, you know, allowed us to film him while he was in trance, and it's amazing.
Wow.
But the more important thing is that what we're now doing is we're tracing our history, you know, right from the get-go. The theory that I came up with was that, you know, we are all products of migration, you know, different forms of migration.
Absolutely.
But we're products of migration, starting with the Bantu ourselves. You know, we migrated from the Nile Valley down to the Great Lakes area, and then eventually crossed the Zambezi, coming down south and going all the way down to the coast. That was the first migration. Then the second migration was Mfecane.
From the southward
migration. Of the Nguni coming through, you know, South Africa itself, what is now South Africa and what is now Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Zambia, Malawi, going up to Tanzania, you know. And then you had the migration of the colonialists, you know, mainly the Portuguese. Most people think that it was the British who were the first to come to this part of the world. That's actually the Portuguese. You know, the British only came 400 years later. You know, these are things that only by starting doing this kind of work, that
going to the archives,
you know, you know. And so you then had the migration southwards during the Federation period.
Wenela.
From, no, not yet. From Malawi.
All right.
And Zambia coming into
Federation of South Africa,
working in the mines and estates, you know. And then, yes, later on in the 70s, you then had a further migration down south to, you know, Wenela and so on.
Fascinating narratives.
And you know what's important in that? In that it then tells us that it is nonsensical for any of us to want to say, ah, this is mine, I belong here, you don't belong here.
Because, I knew you were going there somewhat.
Because where do you belong?
We belong everywhere.
We belong everywhere. And the sooner we're able to accept that and move on as a people, the better we will be for it.
A message that should come from our politicians, isn't
exactly.
it? Yeah, all across. You know. And not this xenophobia
exactly.
that we're seeing all across. Yeah. Nigel, let me take you to, who is Nigel? Where were you born? Where did you go to school?
Okay.
What kind of influence did you have from your parents, and where did you grow up?
Yeah. Well, Nigel is your typical born Rokishan.
Right.
You know, I was born in Highfield. I grew up in Highfield, and I only left in Fio. Yes. You know, we love that place. Even today, I still go back there, you know. And I only left to go when I went overseas to school. You know, I did my...
Where did you go to which primary schools did you go to?
You know, it's funny. I went to three primary schools in grade one, you know, because that was the time when you had the political infighting between ZANU and ZAPU.
Right.
And it was very, very hot
in Highfield
at that time. So the school that I first went to is called Kuangira, which was closed after the first term because of the rioting that took place. Kuangira was ideal because it was across the road from where my mother's creche was. You know, but then from Kuangira, I then went to Mija, you know, for another term, but that was too far out. And the third term, I then went to Mbizi, you know. So in 1 year, I went to three schools, you know. And then from there, I came down to Chipembere. Chipembere is much closer to home,
right?
You know. So I then did the rest of my primary schooling at Chipembere Primary School.
And high school?
High school, I went to Mazoe Secondary School.
All right.
And from there, I then went to the United States. First went to University of Missouri. I just did a year and a half there, but this is to share, to tell you how crazy I am about football. Missouri did not have a varsity football team. So I asked our sponsors to find me a college that had a varsity
team. And Penn State was
there. Penn State had one. So I transferred to Penn State, where I finished the remaining 2 years of my...
And what did you study at Penn State?
I studied food science.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, when I went, I wanted to be a biochemist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you start, you're assigned an advisor. So my advisor sat me down and was like, okay, what do you want to study? You know, biochemistry. And I was like, yeah, but what do you want to do with biochemistry? I said, well, I want to be able to feed my people when I go back home. And then he says, well, maybe there's another way. You know, there's a, you know, a degree called food science, which would do what you want to do. And I then became a food scientist.
Is there any of the food science mm-hmm. in what you're doing now?
No.
I ask that deliberately because I find it fascinating with our journeys, mm-hmm. Nigel, that where we start, that does not necessarily mean that's where we're going to end.
Yeah.
That there's this serendipity in life that takes us to different places.
Yes.
And that the most important thing is to embrace that serendipity, to enjoy it and not to fight it. Look at where you are with your science degree.
Yeah. I would say university education or any, higher education, tertiary education, is to give you the ability to think logically.
Right.
You know, what you then do with it afterwards is very different. Mm. You know, and that's what I got, you know, in that food science got me to appreciate, you know, the importance of food in life and so on. But beyond that, you know, it just got me to understand that there are processes, you know. Food is processed. You have to take it through certain processes.
Your family, your brother, Rod World, who I know so well, Mike Munyati was a national institution. I sat on the nation with at ZBC with Mike Munyati from time to time. You would invite me there. Talk to me about the influence that came from your parents and you growing up with Rodwell Munyati, with Mike Munyati. What did you get most from your parents?
Wow. You know, the fact that they were social entrepreneurs, you know, my dad was into music. And, you know, in the 60s and 70s, what used to happen was that, you know, you had talented musicians who wanted to play, but they didn't have the resources to be able to buy their own instruments. So what would happen is they would find a businessman or some such person with means who would buy the instruments, and then they would play for him and they would share the earnings. So that's how my dad, you know, got into music. And many of the musicians who were successful in your 70s and early 80s passed through my father's stable.
Wow.
Oliver Mtukudzi, he used to live not far from where we lived. He would tell people that I played my first electric guitar in Mr. Munyati's house.
What was Munyati's first name? Mr. Munyati's first name?
Dixon.
Dixon Munyati.
And, you know, he used to play in one of my father's bands. And when he left, he gave him that guitar as a gift. So Oliver would always, each time, you know, we met and there were people saying, you know, it was because of his father that I am who I am today.
Wow.
But it wasn't just him. James Chimombe was also part of the group, which is why later on in the 80s, they actually made songs together because of their, you know, experience being part of Mr. Munyati's bands, you know. So I grew up with music around me. But the funny thing is I could never play. Even today, I cannot play an instrument. But that was because, you know, I was my father's apprentice. My father used to make his own speaker boxes and so on. And I ended up being that young man who went with the band when they were playing. We played Stoddard Hall.
Carrying around equipment.
Carrying around equipment, setting it up, and collecting the money at the door. And then at the end of the show, I would actually pay the band their due. It was always 50-50. I'd pay them their half and take our half to my dad. You know,
something that has always fascinated me, where does the voice come from? Is it your mom? Is it your dad? Because Rodwell Munyati, Mike Munyati, may his soul rest in peace, and Nigel, your voices are, it's just like I'm listening to Mike speaking. It's like I'm listening to Rodwell. Where is that? Yeah. Where does that come from?
It's,
is that your dad or
your... From our dad.
Wow.
You know, and it would be funny sometimes, you know, someone would call home, you know, wanting to talk to our parents. I would answer the phone. And one time there was this woman who assumed it was my dad who picked up the phone, but it was me. I was like, hello. And she started, you know, joking, you know, adult jokes. And I was like, I don't think.
I don't think this is for me.
And she was like, no, it's you. I know it's you. I was like, Dad, please come.
This is
quickly.
This is an issue.
Yeah. But yeah, we're like that. And even our children, our kids, you know, have the voice as well. Mm. So it's a family
How
legacy.
How many kids do you have, Mike?
Ish. Six.
Listen to me saying Mike instead of Nigel.
I'm used to it. I call it an honor to be associated with Mike.
Mike, yeah. What an institution. Mm. I must press you here. Mm. Have you ever failed? Or is your failure that Zifa thing where you got zero votes?
Yeah, that was my biggest failure, mainly in the sense that I was too naive to realize that I am not as effective as I thought I was. Because I had thought that, you know, if I sit down with you, Trevor, and I impress you with the things I'm promising to do, that would be good enough. Mm-hmm. But the reality was, no, that's not what works. Mm-hmm. You've got to give me this. Mm-hmm. And I was...
Do you regret not having paid?
Yeah, no. I actually feel that it exonerated me. Mm. I'm proud of it. The fact that I refused to pay, I may have lost, but I've set, you know, someone was saying to me the other day, you and Lincoln Mtasa are the only two people who refused to pay councillors and lost. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, yeah, I'm happy to.
What lessons did that teach you?
It taught me to stick to my, you know, my principles.
At a cost.
At a cost. Regardless of what it may cost you, you must be principled. Because if you don't, if you sell your soul to the devil, you know, you have nothing left that makes you, you know, human, as it were. You know, so I think that has always been one of the things that my parents taught me. You know, particularly my mother, you know, she was one person who was always, you know, about doing the right thing. And I remember once, you know, as a deputy minister, you know, she'd have a car. There was 504 and a driver at home. And it was on a Saturday. And I needed to go to the shops in Waterfalls. We used to stay in Waterfalls then. And the shops were like 5 minutes away. So I persuaded the driver. I said, you know, can you just take me to the shops? You know, went. It didn't take more than 15 minutes. I was back. But my mother knew that the car had left. You know, she was so mad. She was saying, you don't, that's not how you do things. This is
so
not
to the driver
car.
Or to you?
To me.
To you.
You know, this is not our car. This is government property and da-da-da-da-da. You know, and I see nowadays, you know, ministers' children, they're running around with all these government vehicles and so on. And I'm like, you know, if my mother was around today, she would be saying, no, that's not the right thing to do, you know. And it's being principled, you know. That's one of the things that I think I take away from
it. There's a price to pay for being principled,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Tell me, lastly, before we go to books, when you go to Highfields, is it the same Highfields that you grew up in?
It breaks my heart.
Breaks your heart.
To go back.
Talk
to
me about that.
And it's so many other people share the same experience, you know. The house you grew up in, you know, it's become so dilapidated that you say to yourself, this can't be the same house I grew up in. And even when you take your kids there, you know, like, that's the house. And they'll be like, oof, wow. And yet, when you look at pictures of the houses when they were, you know, they were not in the state that they are in now. You know, which is one of the things that is very sad, in that our urban spaces, our urban environment has deteriorated in quality. And I feel sorry for those people who have to grow up in those environments today. You know, and I say to people, you know, you've got a kid today who has grown up in an environment where across the road from their house, there is a rubbish heap where people just dump garbage. Now, that child will grow up thinking that that's normal. And then when they become an adult, a decision maker,
they replicate the same thing.
Yeah. Hopefully there will be some interventions in the process that will make them realize that, no, there are better ways of doing things, you know. So that's one of the things that I find very unfortunate, very sad. But, you know, it's a sign of the times.
Nigel, I'm not going to let you go before I ask you to share your books, the books that you've read, Nigel, that is that have made an impact on you.
Okay. You know, very interestingly, I don't read much, but, you know, over the 60 plus years, I must have read something. But some of the things that some of the books that I've enjoyed, you know, it's like, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Love in the Time of Cholera. You know, that's a very, very good book about love and perseverance and so on. You know, you've got The Alchemist by Paul Coelho.
Beautiful book.
You know, and that's one book that makes you stop and think about your life. You know, it's all about introspection, about choosing, you know, what are the things that are important in life. You know, and I think that got me to stop and think. The first one was about love, and I'm a romantic, so, you know, that was...
We need romantics around.
Yeah. And then the other one that I read in high school was called Jeka Nyika. And that was, you know, one of the experiences that made me, I think, look at life the way I do today. You know, being a kid born in the urban environment, and we never really went to the rural areas. Maybe one holiday a year we would go to the rural areas, you know, maybe for a week or two. But that, so my experience with
Jeka Nyika, who wrote that book?
By Francis Mugugu.
Okay.
And it was about, you know, life in, you know, in the prehistoric times. And, you know, it was about how society was and raids, how they would raid other chiefdoms and, you know, take the food, wives, cattle, and so on. You know, that for someone who is in an urban environment, it's something that you really, it's
foreign.
Surreal. Yeah. You know, and I think that's where part of my interest in finding out more about our history, where we came from,
the narratives
came from. Now I love the raw areas. Yeah. You know, I enjoy being out there. But as a youngster, I did not.
Yeah.
And I also now appreciate life beyond the urban environment. You know, there are people who did not grow up in an urban environment and have actually done a lot better, you know, in life. So sometimes you tend to think that just because you are from, you know, the townships, you are better off. In fact, most of the people from the townships are the ones who are worse off now, because you always thought because you are in Harare, everything was fine.
Was well.
The person who grew up in the rural area is like, no, I must, you know, they strove to do more, and they've succeeded much more, you know.
Nigel, you and I could go on and on. You know, you bring back the good old days, and you have had an amazing life, and you continue to have a great life. Giving back so much into our society, and absolutely admire what you're doing. I was actually reflecting and saying, this man has been so many things and is still going on. So continue doing what you're doing, you know, giving life to the dreams of those young people. Those young people are our future. So, Nigel, thank you so much for creating the time to join us.
Thank you, Trevor. And it's really indeed a pleasure being on your show.
Thank you.
You also do some fantastic work in getting people to understand more about what life is.
Thank you.
You know, and I know sometimes it's been at great risk, but you never give up. You know, you are an inspiration also to young people out there that there is good in following what you believe.
You know? Nigel, thank you so much. Allow me to turn now to our viewers who are all over the world, who support us on a weekly basis. Remember, we are out every Monday on YouTube, 7 a.m. Central African time. We invite you to subscribe to our channel so that you don't miss out on any of these quality conversations, such as the one I've had with my good friend, Nigel. When you do subscribe, you will receive an alert when we have one of these quality conversations. We also invite you to share your comments, share the episodes with as many people as possible. We've gone a step further, by the way. We are on all podcast platforms. Scroll down and click onto the link, podcast link, for your listening pleasure. Until next time, cheers to you all.